Hi everyone, and welcome to again another episode of Literacy Works with Bedrock Learning, where we are bringing you the most interesting and insightful voices of across the world of education. Today we're really fortunate to have Rekha Sharma, who runs curriculum assessment for Avanti Schools Trust. And thank you for joining us today. I've come across both of your books on X, as we should now call it. Really interesting. I think they're fantastic. So I thought you'd be a great person to have on. So thank you for agreeing to come on today. It's fantastic that you're here.
Hi, Andy. Thanks for having me.
Let's start off. I'd like to hear a little bit about you and your role in your schools and your vision for sort of uniting curriculum assessment across those three. That's no small task. That's no small task. So I'd love to hear about that.
Yeah, of course. So I'm the School Improvement Lead for Curriculum and Assessment at the Avanti Schools Trust. And what that looks like is essentially thinking about those kind of golden threads of curriculum and assessment that we want to align across our schools. For us, alignment is about really thinking about the ways in which we can collaborate most meaningfully, and also bringing expertise together from across the trust to have a think about curriculum development, and strengthening individual schools' curriculum provision, while still maintaining what's quite unique about each school and each setting, which is great. I've been doing it for over a year now. It's a pretty big role, but I really enjoy the kind of focus around assessment, but also working really closely with the other school improvement leaders who lead on CPD, teaching and learning and inclusion. So working kind of as a collective to try and think about how best we can support our schools. The books are really exciting. I really enjoyed writing both of them. They're two very small handbooks, one around curriculum principles, curriculum primary curriculum development, and then one more recent around building the right culture within our schools and how leaders can create the right conditions for their teams to really thrive and flourish.
When it comes to curriculum and assessment, and obviously CPD and things linked to that, what are your values? What do you think? What do you put as first and foremost in your mind when you get up in the morning and you go to work? What are the things that you really pride yourself on?
I think one of the things is really thinking about strength and quality of provision, and making sure that it's really equitable. So pupils are getting a really, really good deal when it comes to the curriculum within a school. I think that's really, really important, and that we're considering how, through our curriculum development, we can really strengthen that vision for and incentive pupils that we have. I think that context is really important in that. So every school has a very unique context, different challenges, different opportunities within their localities. And so the work of curriculum for me should be very, very bespoke to an individual school. And I guess it's finding that balance between having that alignment across schools within trusts, and also then having that individual bespoke learning development for a school based on their unique kind of demographic, their setup, their story. So that I think is quite important to me. And I think the opportunity for collaboration is really important in school at school level or across schools at trust level. I think that's crucial in us kind of sense making what can be very complicated challenges when it comes to curriculum and assessment. I feel like this kind of top-down approach of this is how we're going to do it just doesn't really work, and so we have to kind of construct solutions to some of those really nitty problems of curriculum and assessment.
The obvious follow-up to that is how do those values feed into those your books and the why behind those books? I think they are an absolute triumph. For those of you who are looking for your next edu book read, I think pick one of these two up, and we'll link to them in the description below on the podcast. I think they're fantastic. So if you could maybe just talk us through the books and kind of how your values just see through those books, that would be fantastic.
Yeah, of course. I mean, that piece around collaboration, I think, is a core one. And I felt like when I was writing both of the books that I wanted it to be a contribution to a wider conversation around curriculum and culture. And so really, it's my kind of very small contribution to a much wider discourse around both of these things. And so that very much comes through in the book. So the first book around curriculum was Curriculum to Classroom, essentially just a case study of how myself and colleagues developed the curriculum from scratch in a primary school in South London. And it just talks about the very real challenges we had, you know, the good, the bad, the ugly, and being quite candid about those and actually thinking about what were the lessons learnt from that that other colleagues could maybe incorporate into their curriculum development work too. So there was a real sense of me wanting to share a kind of worked example of what that journey looks like and some of the things that could potentially support curriculum development for all subject leaders and coordinators. So, you know, there's a big heavy focus in the book on curriculum principles and how you can develop those so that you've got a really coherent curriculum provision offer across your subjects in primary, as just an example. And then Building Culture was the follow-on book. And I think that came about through my experiences as a leader in the sector and feeling that actually without getting those conditions and culture right, curriculum work, whether it's assessment you're developing, inclusion you're looking at, culture and getting those conditions right is really central and a real prerequisite to really great implementation of anything. And so I think it came about at a time where I probably realised this has to come first, like this has to be really central to our thinking as leaders, because if we don't get those conditions right, we just have these kind of volatile, unstable environments where teachers are coming and going and there's lots of mobility in staff and people are just very unhappy and not finding the joy in their work. And so actually then the focus kind of shifted more to building culture and thinking about what leaders can do practically in their day-to-day school improvement strategic thinking that might support getting those conditions right, which I think is also kind of really timely given the retention challenges we're seeing in the sector at the moment. So yeah, kind of the story of how the books have evolved.
I read them recently, really interesting, and they brought up Maslow's hierarchy. I was thinking I've seen that one about, you know, basics being covered before the other stuff. But people often say now that Maslow was almost misunderstood, and the idea that the tip of the iceberg, the triangle, so to speak, isn't so much about, you know, getting the basics right. It's more self-actualization. What he was talking about was more about self-actualization and about what kind of where that really enriching stuff happens. And what would your best examples be where culture has, you know, the culture has permeated, you know, the curriculum and where things have really started to tip? Have you got any particular examples or, you know, of places where that's happened?
Sure. I mean, there's certainly been schools I've worked in as a leader, you know, where before our leadership team arrived, there was maybe 5 heads in 5 years, quite low staff morale, quite weak school culture there. How we have tried during our time in the school to try and fold some of that culture stuff into the school improvement work that we're doing. And, you know, it's not just the schools that I've worked in. I've seen other leaders do this really skillfully, where they focused first on getting the culture and the conditions right. So they focused first on having shared language around why we're here, why we're doing what we're doing, and having an understanding, you know, around developing trust and having those conversations where teachers feel like they are co-constructing that curriculum. It's not being done to them, very much a part of that process. And where there's been a heavy kind of front loading of that side of things before or during the implementation of, I don't know, a new curriculum or a new assessment model, and where actually staff have felt like they've really been seen and heard and been part of the change, and therefore it's been a stronger change that's lasted longer. So yeah, there's been examples where, you know, I've experienced that under other leaderships. There's been schools that I've worked with where I've seen principals do this really, really well. You know, a school that I'm working with at the moment comes to mind where they're doing exactly the same thing, focusing on getting the conditions right for teachers, and then getting them really involved in the purpose of the school and having that really shared and very clear and crisp understanding of, you know, what they're trying to achieve and how they're doing along that journey. So yeah, there's been a few examples. I feel very privileged to work with some really excellent leaders over, you know, during my career.
It's interesting. one of our core roles in my teaching and learning team here at Bedrock is we work with schools all day, every day, about their implementation. That's a core part of what we do, is talk about implementation. And a big thing that I always frame my meetings with is not, well, this is how you do this, check this, doing this, and then the pupils do this, and then this happens at the end. I always frame my discussions with, well, why have you brought Bedrock into your setting? What problem is it addressing? And I think even just getting leaders and middle leaders and colleagues to articulate why they are partnering with Bedrock, for example, and the hearts and minds thing, because actually, with the best will in the world, it can turn into, have you done your Bedrock? Have you completed this? Off your pop. And actually, it's so much more than that kind of reductionist transaction. It's about democratization of knowledge. It's about, you know, plugging gaps in cultural capital. It's, you know, the sequencing of personalized fiction and non-fiction that makes the, the one we always quote is, if you're in a block three, which is equivalent in year three people with Bedrock, if you read about Galileo, there's further down the line, there's Perseus and all these kind of incredible things. Mm-hmm. And I think once colleagues understand the why, and I know that, you know, the Sinek video and all that stuff has been oft quoted almost to the point where it's a cliche now, but I think it's so important that people understand the why.
Yeah.
And that's really what you're talking about there, isn't it? It's about laying the platform for people to come with you on that journey.
Most definitely. That's a really good point, actually. And I think particularly I remember my days as an English leader. And very early on, I would spend very little time talking about the why. It was always about what we were going to do. We need to do this new reading intervention. We need to raise attainment here.
Yeah.
And actually, the more I kind of learned from other leaders and developed as a leader myself, talking about the why of literacy through looking at reports like, you know, the literacy and life expectancy for the National Literacy Test, it's actually quite sobering reading some of that research and realizing the role that literacy plays across the curriculum and across expectancy. It's crazy to read about. And when you read some research like that, it crystallizes your why in a very, very different way. And I think it conceptualizes it for teachers in a way that they think, wow, actually, no, this is something we really need to, this matters. And they get this understanding of why it matters and the depth of why it matters. And I think that can make all the difference to implementation, because we know what we're doing. We know why we're doing it very clearly. And we know that it's going to have a very meaningful impact on our pupils. And that kind of sequence, I think, is just really, really powerful for implementation.
Yeah, I think also, and we have a particular, I mean, we have two aspects to our platform, for example, but one which is very much, for want of a better term, plug and play. You know, the pupils do it, it's personalized and all that stuff is great. But there's the side to that I'm often trying to develop with colleagues is the insights that we get to bring back into the classroom and the why about going into the platform and bringing those insights back. So if Adam Smith in year seven is putting capital letters at the start of sentences or full stops at the end, it's not necessarily laziness. They genuinely don't have that knowledge. But on the other side, we've got Mapper, which is kind of this enormous repository of 38,000 word plus the curriculum aligned, for example, where staff can actually select the most important pieces of knowledge that colleagues and then have in talk to their classes as well. And then they can check at scale which concepts, which words are causing the problem, which aren't, and that type of thing. Yeah. And the reason I'm sort of going to town on explaining that is because I think beyond it just being about fashion and about, oh, well, let's have a nice curriculum intent document. Yeah. This is about the integrity of staff and colleagues and what you've said before, collaboration, sitting down and saying, well, we're teaching A Christmas Carol, we're teaching Macbeth, we're teaching whatever it is on top, you know, urbanisation and geography or whatever. Never mind 100 words. These are the 10 core concepts we're going to pin everything on. And we're going to make that choice for the pupils. We're going to have the integrity and the bravery to say, yeah, we're going to pin it on that, and then we're going to expand out from there. I think that's something that really chimes with what you were saying earlier about collaboration and underpinning things and making those decisions to support progress, right?
Yeah, most definitely. And I think you were in a real position of privilege as educators, I think, you know, curriculum developers, to make those decisions about what we do and what we don't teach, and making those really deliberate choices. And I think there's a real opportunity cost when it comes to curriculum. And so we need to think really carefully about why we're selecting what we're selecting. And have robust answers to the question, well, why are we doing this? That's a really great question that can sometimes feel like someone's snagging. Actually, it's a really good question to ask, and we need a really good answer for it.
I had a really interesting conversation the other day with Heidi Hughes, who has picked our work, I think she picked 11 words for how to teach Inspector Pauls. Yeah. And I must admit, when she gave her words, when she started naming, I thought, oh, God, what have you picked that one for? But then when she actually got into the conversation, I thought, oh, my God, this is underpinned with real, rich, intricate understanding of the text. And I want to go and teach Inspector Pauls now because I know, I've got it in the more now. And I think, because it's a real representation of you, and I think that's, I think curriculum and choice and taking responsibility, I think that speaks right to the heart of what education should be about. And I think there's a wider discourse going on in this country at the minute that we need to reclaim our profession. I think teachers need to be put right front and centre of social mobility and in being empowered to make those choices. And what's lovely, in all sincerity, about what you're saying about how you go about your job is that you are all about empowering teachers, aren't you? That's really what you stand for, which kind of leads me on to my kind of next thing I wanted to ask you about, which is about creating that sense of psychological safety in your schools. Mm-hmm. And that, I mean, what a massive question, you know, because there's, you know, about staff well-being, about, you know, quality assurance, for want of a better term. What does that look like for you, and what, in terms of when you're leading a school, creating that sense of psychological safety?
Yeah, I mean, psychological safety is, you know, that idea that people feel that they can speak up and there's no fear of kind of repercussion or no fear of them being branded as kind of like the problem child forever. And I think there's no simple solution to this. I feel like it's something that comes about over a long period of time through small, very consistent actions. And I feel like staff voice plays a huge role in this. So having an ongoing conversation about whatever it is we're talking about, what is the thing that we are focusing on, and having an ongoing dialogue around that is crucial to psychological safety, because there first needs to be a space for that conversation to be had. And then I think psychological safety is also about this kind of flattening of the hierarchy, in the sense that, you know, the leader is not always the person who will have that the answer. And so actually it's that kind of distributed leadership where we're able to share and problem solve and sense make together. And actually when the leader gets it wrong, or it has not made the right choice, or hasn't made the right call, is able to kind of just put their hands up and say, actually, that wasn't the right call. I'm going to step back from that. We're going to course correct. And I think, you know, I've been in that position myself in my role, where something has been happening that we've implemented as a team. We decided that hasn't quite worked out, and we've been very open and said, well, it hasn't worked out. You've fed back to us. Actually, we're going to move in this direction. And I find that colleagues will respond to that really well, because it's human. It's real. It's not hiding behind this facade of being this kind of all-knowing or all-seeing leader. And I think, generally speaking, psychological safety comes around from, you know, real connections with people, like real listening, deep listening, and people feeling heard and seen. I think there's a lot of psychological safety that can be derived from just those conversations. You know, there's hallway conversations, the quick pickup of the phone, the quick Teams call. I feel like it's lots of little things over time rather than one sweeping big thing. I feel like there are mechanisms that can really support with creating that kind of shared voice where people feel like they can speak up. And I think staff voice is really critical for that.
Early in my career, I was getting into it with the Senko over email. I was saying, right, I want this. And they were coming back saying, I want that. And I was saying, I want this. And eventually, you know, I remember it to this day. He sought me out and he said, right, let's not continue this over email. Let's have a conversation about it. And my attitude towards the conversation and the issue went from being up here to down. And I thought, do you know what? That's right. Go and have a conversation. And a good colleague at my previous store always said, that's a conversation. That's not an email. And I think modelling that's really important. I mean, even at home with my seven-year-old, I'm never scared to say to him, I got that wrong, mate. I'm really sorry. I shouldn't have shouted that. I was cross, and that he was cross there. And I think you can beat yourself up about shouting. And I really, you know, try and, you know, minimal kind of, I'd like to think single digits over the course of his whole life.
Yeah.
But I think even if you do, and it's okay to admit that you felt cross and have those, and I think human relationships are articulated by honesty, shouldn't they, and openness. But what does that look like for you? I mean, I love what you've said there, but what does that look like for you when it comes to, for example, curriculum? I mean, the vastness of your job is just, it's huge, but how do you almost encode that across different schools, different subjects? What does that look like? How do you go about doing that? Because there'll be a lot of people listening to you that will want to hear how you go about doing this, I think.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I definitely don't claim to be the expert of this, but what I have tried to fold into my kind of day-to-day practices is this the notion and mindset that actually curriculum is never done. And I think what that really helps kind of enforce is this idea that actually we are going to get it wrong. That's part of the process to getting to the best provision. And actually, because it's never done, we are going to try new things and innovate and make mistakes, and that's okay. And we can learn from those mistakes and move forward. And I think that kind of culture of continuous improvement is really, really important to me. So, you know, it's something that I try to model through my own working practices by being really clear where I've potentially thought something and then that thinking has evolved. So thinking and discussing and explicitly talking about the power of rethinking. There's an organizational psychologist called Adam Grant, and he talks about this, you know, the idea of you don't know what you don't know. And that's true for everyone, whether you're an executive leader or whatever your role might be, it's true for everyone. So I think in terms of curriculum specifically, it's about keeping that mindset of this is continually evolving. It's a continual conversation, and therefore we need to be trying new things, being creative, innovating, getting it wrong, failing, all of that then becomes okay. And that kind of opens the door to psychological safety, opens the door for people to say, actually, that's not working. I'm going to move in this direction and try this. And for me to say, okay, great, go for it. Rather than this kind of notion of one person holding the kind of the knowledge and dispersing it outwards. It's kind of co-constructed, which I think for me feels like the right way to do things, because, you know, everyone has their expertise. We want to draw that together. We want to bring people together. And essentially, I think the main thing as well that's quite important for leaders, I think, is to maintain this idea of having their leader hat on and their teacher hat on. And sometimes when you're in a role like mine, it's, you are a little bit more removed from the classroom, and therefore you have to have that time where I will just go and plan a unit of geography and just do it for myself and go through that process and remind myself of what the very real challenges are when we're looking at curriculum, you know, time constraints, trying to get through the curriculum. How do we navigate that? What do we do when the learning is not secured and we need to reteach that? Where do we do that? Really, you know, interesting and knotty challenges, but by keeping my kind of teacher hat on as well as my leader hat on, I'm able to kind of focus on the things that are going to make the biggest difference in the classroom. So hopefully I'd like to think some of those practices are helping to create psychological safety. And I think the other thing is I'm constantly on the lookout for feedback for my own leadership. You know, I did the Leadership Matters 360, whatever. And that was really useful because I just got tons of feedback from lots of colleagues. Massively, hugely. Yeah. And, you know, I was dreading opening the results because I just thought, oh my gosh, I'm going to read this stuff about me.
Yeah.
But it was the most powerful thing for my own development. And I think if both leaders and teachers can instill that kind of reflective, you know, chuck the ego out the window, fine, we've all got strengths, we've all got weaknesses. I want to know what mine are. I don't want them to remain in this blind spot behind me. I can't see them and they're impacting my work and my relationships and, you know, my colleagues. So yeah, it was probably the best thing I've done in terms of my own professional development, to just keep focusing on continuous improvement for all.
Do you find that, you know, this idea of you not being the expert and being top down, do schools embrace that, or do some schools, do some colleagues like to be told, you know, well, this is what we're doing here and here? How does that work in lots of different contexts?
I think it depends on the nature of what you're leading on. So I think there are certain things, you know, assessment guidance or assessment, how you're delivering assessments in schools. That's something that's a fairly straightforward, people prefer clear guidance on what needs to be done.
Yeah, they do.
That's a tricky one to, that's something as a trust I feel like can be provided to schools and be a helpful addition. Where it's something like the structure of the curriculum, I feel like co-construction is quite valuable and important. So I think it needs to be very dependent on the context of the situation and what it is you're leading on and what it is you're working on. But yeah, I feel like clear guidance is sometimes very, very helpful. And in other situations, the co-constructed kind of model is really, really good.
It's interesting because I think my biggest challenge when I was leading on English across the school was this idea that I had, and it got better, I felt, over the course of time that I was in the role. But you have all these kind of high, wonderful ideas about the curriculum, and then it's making assessment meet it. And I just wonder, how do you do that? For, you talk about collaborating on the curriculum structure and things like that, but then how do you, what does a common assessment framework look like? Is curricular are very different across different even departments or different schools? Yeah. What does a common assessment framework look like in terms of how often you assess, what you assess? What does that look like? That must be quite tough to marry those two together.
Yeah, and we tend to think about it as frameworks, not policies. So thinking about the kind of core headline things that we all can agree on that are our common ground, golden principles, golden threads, whatever you might want to call them for assessment. And then thinking about how they're personalized within schools, which are based on, a very specific context and how schools might want to kind of play that out within their schools. So our focus is more on coming together with leaders. And again, conversation around what is it that we can all agree on about assessment? How many times do we want to assess? Da, da, da. Those top headline things, which then allows the space for schools to go back and lead that in the ways that they choose and see fit for their context. I think that's, for example, a way of that kind of co-constructed model. And I guess my role in that is providing colleagues with the information that might inform their thinking around making those decisions, and sharing things like evidence-informed practices and best practice models, so that senior leaders can make some really informed decisions about things and then think about, okay, well, what does this look like within my school and how they want to do that within their context, but also in light of their cultural readiness as a school and where they're staff are at and what's been happening in their school, because that in itself is like a little you've got these kind of mini cultures almost that are operating, and actually schools need to be thinking about those as well. So it is a tricky balance.
I spoke the other week to Peter Twining, who wrote the book From EdTech to PedTech. It's a really interesting book, and he said he's a fascinating guy, and he said that you can talk about things like implementation of an EdTech solution that you bring into your school, and you've got one EdTech solution, like whether it's a quizzing platform or whatever it is, but what you are missing if you are implementing top down is that, as what you just hit on there, Lekha, is this idea that every teacher brings their own set of political, philosophical ideas about how teaching is done, what education is. Is it co-constructed? Is it didactic? And you can have the simplest thing, which is almost like a very simple A or B quizzing platform, but the way that a teacher, the way that a school, the way that whoever it is implements that will be very different. And I think what I like about what you just said there is that you are respecting the values and the experiences that every teacher, every school is bringing to to the golden threads or whatever it is that you're presenting and that you're providing with them. That sounds like a really encouraging, sounds like a great place to work, sounds like a great organisation to be part of.
Absolutely.
I'm sure you'd agree.
I'm biased, but I definitely agree.
So in terms of looking to the future then, what are your goals in terms of, in your current role? What are you working on at the moment? And actually, have you thought of any further publications on the spot as well? Is there anything in the pipeline you can tell us about?
Yeah. So in terms of what I'm working on at the moment, we have an Avanti Middle Leaders program that we're developing at the moment, which is kind of designed to supplement the MPQ and focus more on the cultural and relational side of leadership development, which is something we're really excited about. continuing to support subject leaders in their development and them really owning their subjects and being able to drive their subjects forward through that body of work as well, which is really exciting. And we're doing some subject development work as well, looking at designing some kind of Avanti-specific subjects within our schools as well. So our PRE, which is Philosophy, Religion and Ethics curriculum. So all very exciting bits of work. And in terms of publications, I've had a few kind of ideas around how to build on the work on building culture. And I guess just been thinking about how I might make that a bit more actionable for leaders. You know, the building culture, there's a lot of theory in it, but actually how do we take that and make it something that leaders can kind of work with every single day to lead their teams? So yeah, hopefully.
Like a field guide.
Yeah, watch this space, who knows.
Yeah, I've had the idea that I might go and do that.
There you go.
that sounds great. I think that would be really popular. I think that would be great, and I'm sure people would love to read it. But thank you so much for your time. It's been, you know, you're very generous to give it up and with everything you're doing. So it means a lot. And I know people will be really grateful for hearing your voice in this space. It's been wonderful. And hopefully we'll speak to you again.
Thank you. Thanks for having me, Andy.
Yeah, thank you.
Bye.